Okay, thank you, Gautam, and thank you, Mike, for the invitation to speak in this session. This is my first time at this meeting. I'm very impressed already. So I've been breeding shrub willow since 1998, and my talk is going to be a little bit different from the previous talks in this session because I'm going to discuss our breeding program with a little bit of genomics. So we think that shrub willow is a viable biomass or bioenergy crop for the Northeast for a number of reasons. We've been growing willow in central and upstate New York as a crop since the late 1800s. And here you see a picture from the Liverpool Willow Museum, where Liverpool was a center of the willow basket industry at that time. In 1905, they made 350,000 willow baskets by hand. So we have been cultivating willow in regularly harvested stool beds since that time. It's a crop that's well suited for our area, for our cool, wet climate. It grows well on the marginal soils that we have, which are poorly drained, heavy soils, and produces high yields, relatively high yields of wood chips, which are well adapted for existing wood chip-based renewable energy systems and logistic systems. So as some of the previous speakers have mentioned, we have multiple potential markets with different needs and compositional requirements. But again, in the Northeast, we think there's an excellent market for combined heat and power, for co-firing with coal. And there's a picture of one of our wood-fired power plants that we have in New York State. We have a number of small-scale cogen or combined heat and power facilities that are getting started up on the range of 1 to 5 megawatts. We're looking forward to the possibility of providing feedstock to the liquid transportation fuel industry, but that really hasn't gotten started yet. But again, another big need in the Northeast is for small-scale heat, whether it's home heating and pellet stoves, or again, small industrial heat with high efficiency wood chip boilers. The Northeast, meaning the New England states and New York, use 84% of the heating fuel in the country. So there is great potential to, again, replace our oil imports and convert our energy use to a local source by using wood for heat in the Northeast. So here's an outline of my talk. I'm going to spend about the first half giving you an introduction to short rotation willow cultivation. I'm sure it's new to many of you. Talk a little bit about our breeding program, and then talk about the work of one of my PhD students on looking at the molecular genetic basis for differences in biomass composition. So this is typical of the marginal agricultural land that we're looking to plant willow on in the Northeast and upper Midwest. It is land that perhaps was abandoned or is used in a marginal basis from the decline of our dairy industry. It includes land that again cannot support high yields of food and feed crops, and instead may be mowed occasionally for low value hay. This particular site is 3.5 acres at a local high school, where we've planted demonstration plots of willow, switchgrass, and energy sorghum all in one place, one of the top FFA programs in the state, if not in the country. So we have to kill that existing vegetation, and I realized just now it's a little bit silly for me to show a picture of plowing at the Agronomy Society meeting, but I want to highlight a few points here. This crop is grown over a period of 25 to perhaps as many as 30 years. So this is our one chance to do site prep on land that has been in established grasslands or scrubland for many years. It may have an extensive weed seed bank or well-established perennial weeds. So we need to do it right. We have been doing, again, broad-spectrum herbicide application and traditional plowing, but I think there's great opportunity to use conservation tillage and to incorporate cover crops to make the system more sustainable, both in terms of the carbon that's released during this traditional plowing and to try to minimize our use of herbicides in the first 2 years, which weed control is critical in the establishment of this crop. So there's some of the ag students there out doing the plowing at the high school. We plant with a mechanical planter that starts with 8-foot-long whips. These are stems grown in the nursery bed for a year. The planter, you feed whips into four locations, so it's planting four rows at a time. Traditional 30-inch spacing between the rows with 5-foot alleys in between those double rows. The planter cuts those whips into 8-inch pieces, sticks them into the ground, and those unrooted cuttings are quickly established. At the end of that establishment year, we usually have 5 to 7, maybe 8 feet of growth. This is the growth at that plot that I've been showing you, the end of 2009. And then we'll cut that back or coppice it. And the following year, that stimulates vigorous regrowth of multiple small diameter stems. Coppice regrowth, so this is the growth, typically 8 to 14 feet of height growth of multiple small diameter stems from just a few weeks ago here. We would wait until the end of the third or fourth growing season to harvest that. We harvest in the wintertime when the leaves have fallen and the nutrients are largely returned to the soil, when the ground on those typically wet sites is frozen, hopefully, but not with too much snow, and also at the peak time of our heating season. We harvest now. New Holland has developed a specialized cutter head for their forage harvesting system, adapted for willow and poplar. So that cut and chip system is one of the harvesting options. But there are many options being explored, including whole stem bundling and, in fact, a baling system that cuts stems and produces large round bales. We do fertilize. Our standard rate is 100 pounds of nitrogen per acre after every harvest, so that's every 3 years, although the accumulating research is that that's probably not necessary, maybe only to meet a minimum level of fertility initially. And then the cycle continues through at least 7 harvests. At least that's what we modeled the economics on. So more than 20 years. So again, we've been breeding willow in New York State since 1998. This includes some of the work that I started at SUNY ESF in Syracuse. There's great potential, as you can imagine, to improve willow through breeding. There's been very little domestication except for basket making, and I doubt there was ever any breeding for basket making. We've modeled that every 20% increase in yield will reduce our costs and should encourage adoption of the crop. We have lots of genetic diversity, over 300 species of willow globally, and a short generation time. We get flowers within 2 years. Again, this is a clonally propagated crop, so we can take advantage of heterosis and epistatic inheritance. Many species can hybridize. Some of those species combinations do display heterosis. Others do not, so that's one thing we've been working on for the last few years, is trying to look at all of the different species combinations that we can make in the subgenus Vitrix of the genus Salix. That includes some tetraploid species that cross well with diploid species. So many of our high-yielding varieties are triploids, it appears, so we're seeking more information on those right now. And then from those hybrid species, hybrid families, we do first a family selection and then plant into replicated selection trials. This is our most recent trial, planted in 2008 with 76 clones, 3 replicates actually on 2 sites. I'm showing you the data from one. And one of our early indicators of eventual biomass yield is to measure first year post-coppice stem area calculated by measuring the diameters of all the stems in a stool. And that's a very good indicator of third year biomass yield. So you can see that at least in this selection trial, we're getting somewhere around 15 to 20% increase in yield of our top varieties over our current reference variety, SX61. And you also see the wide range of genetic diversity in this trial of different species and species hybrids. From a previous selection trial that was planted in 2002, we selected about 18 or so varieties to propagate and plant onto regional yield trials. So we have now a number of yield trials across New York State, some of which have been harvested by now. And the top varieties in those yield trials were producing 6 dry tons per acre per year. And we've gotten a lot of interest from collaborators, and Tim Volk is managing yield trials in the DOE Regional Feedstock Partnership Program. So we have planted willow essentially across North America and across several hardiness zones at this point, and are sharing our material with breeding programs in Europe as well. Finally, the final step in our breeding program is to encourage commercialization. We've patented 7 of our varieties and have now licensed those to a very entrepreneurial nurseryman in New York State, Dennis Rack, who has formed the company AA Willow. So if you want to buy any of these varieties, you can go to AAWillow.com. He has a capacity to produce 30 million cuttings a year. Okay, so as previous speakers have mentioned, there are a number of potential conversion systems that we could target in our feedstock development programs. We're not sure which one is going to win out. So our approach has been to characterize the diversity of biomass composition that we do see in our breeding program, and now to do a pilot study to look at the molecular genetic basis for that diversity of biomass composition. The first step that we encountered was to develop a reasonably high throughput method for analyzing biomass composition. And we worked together with Art Stepanovich in the chemistry department at SUNY ESF in Syracuse with an instrument that he has called the High-Resolution Thermogravimetric Analyzer, or TGA. So this is essentially a very sensitive scale inside of an oven that heats small amounts of biomass, 10 to 20 milligrams. And as it is heating that, the biomass pyrolyzes or combusts. We do it in an air environment. And the machine then slows the heating process as it hits a conversion point, an inflection in the thermogram, which is the black curve there. And based on analysis of pure compounds, we can then resolve the phases of heating that represent the combustion or pyrolysis of hemicellulose, cellulose, and lignin. Each run takes about an hour, has an autoloader with 18 samples, so we can run 18 samples in a day about per machine. So my last PhD student, Michelle Serapelia, worked to develop a calibration set, first by analyzing biomass composition by traditional wet chemistry, and then correlating that with the model that she developed for biomass composition for the high-resolution TGA. And we get correlations of 0.74 for cellulose, 0.86 for hemicellulose, and 0.76 for lignin. So we have a pretty good method for analyzing biomass composition from untreated samples. And what I should say is that the repeatability of the TGA method is very precise. So I think the variation that we're seeing in these correlations is probably much more in the wet chemistry than it is in the TGA analysis. So we've used that technique to analyze all of our commercial varieties, everything that's in yield trials. We do see variation in composition by site, so that's something we're very interested in, as well as significant variation by variety, which I'm not showing you here. What I'm showing you is analysis of a family, a species hybrid family, with 6 progeny and the 2 parents. So definitely a pilot study in looking at the segregation of compositional traits across a family. So again, we do see variation in cellulose, hemicellulose, perhaps not so much variation in this particular family in lignin composition. And then we've gone on to clone some of the key genes involved in lignin, cellulose, and hemicellulose biosynthesis, including cellulose synthase genes, UDP glucose dehydrogenase, and a number of glycosyl transferase genes, as well as COMT, caffeyl-CoA O-methyltransferase, and cinnamyl alcohol dehydrogenase. So we've looked now at those three genes in the phenylpropionate pathway. Okay, so what we've done then, what Michelle did was to analyze patterns of gene expression in those six progeny in two different tissues, as well as the two parents. She did the immediate shoot tip, which I've called apex here, and then the region of likely secondary cell wall development lower down on the stem. And again, we do see differences in levels of gene expression in those two tissues for each of the three lignin biosynthetic enzymes, as well as differences between the two tissues within a genotype. Okay, and interestingly for those genes, we're actually seeing higher expression in the shoot tip than in the region lower down on the stem. We also see differential expression of some of the cellulose synthase genes. And these differences, again, highlight that some of these genes are more likely involved in secondary cell wall deposition with higher levels of expression lower down on the stem. And then the final step was to try to correlate the patterns of gene expression that we see with differences in biomass composition of those same eight genotypes characterized by thermogravimetric analysis. And we do see some significant correlations, a negative correlation between the caffeyl-CoA O-methyltransferase in the shoot tip versus cellulose composition. We see variable correlations for the glycosyl transferases, although a strong positive correlation between UDP glucose dehydrogenase expression and lignin composition, which is an interesting correlation, deserves further attention, but may be related to diversion of precursors, monosaccharide precursors, away from cellulose biosynthesis. And then finally, some more consistent negative correlations between cellulose synthase levels and lignin composition, and two of those genes do show positive correlations with cellulose composition. So this is definitely a pilot study. I think, again, a couple of take-home messages. We do see significant differences in biomass composition, also significant differences in the patterns of gene expression among genotypes in a segregating family. But we definitely need genomics to expand on this study. And we've been very lucky to work with Jerry Tuscan at Oak Ridge National Lab. And I also collaborate with Chris Town at the J. Craig Venter Institute. We now are in the process of sequencing the Salix purpurea genome. This is a diploid species. Its genome size should be comparable to that of poplar, with the expectation that we can use largely short-read next-gen sequencing to align with the Populus trichocarpa genome. Initially, this was proposed essentially as a resequencing project of Populus trichocarpa. This is a highly heterozygous species, and it's going to be an interesting challenge for genome assembly. So this is what we have. I'm a novice genomicist, so don't press me too hard on this, but these are the data that we've just gotten in the last month that are just now entering the assembly and bioinformatics pipelines. We've sequenced ESTs from eight tissue libraries that we've provided, and we're in the process of getting some back libraries constructed to do some back sequencing and back end sequencing as well. Okay, so hopefully The next time I speak, it can be more of a genomics talk and a little bit less of breeding, but the long-term goal is to be able to integrate genomics into our applied willow breeding program. If you have questions or are interested in willow, please go to our new website, which we're calling Willowpedia. And I want to thank my co-authors on this paper, Kim Cameron, Michelle Serapelia in my lab, and Art Stepanovich at SUNY ESF, as well as our other collaborators in federal and state funding agencies. So thanks for your attention.
We have time for a question.
Do you have any of the same material in your breed program that they have in the European program?
Yeah, so the question is, what material do we share with the European breeding programs? Thanks for that. I should have mentioned that there are about 35,000 acres of willow in cultivation in Sweden, probably about 12,000 acres in England. And most of there have been long-term breeding programs in Sweden and in the UK, older than our breeding program. And most of those are based on Salix viminalis. We've tested many of those commercial varieties in New York, and most of them, the ones based on Salix viminalis, are highly susceptible to potato leafhopper. They suffer severe hopper burn, curling of the leaves, senescence of the leaves as soon as the potato leafhopper comes in. So we learned early on that we could not rely on most of the varieties, any of the varieties developed in the Swedish and UK breeding programs, and had instead to develop unique pedigrees for North America. We are collaborating with them on genomics efforts, though, and we're seeking a mapping population of Salix viminalis crossed by Salix purpurea. They're working on sequencing the Salix viminalis genome.
Thank you, Larry.
Okay.